The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With the all-new Nissan Juke. The coupe crossover by Nissan. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
My next guest, Anthony Cleary, experienced the terrible explosion in Beirut yesterday firsthand. He's an Irishman who lived about a half a kilometre from the blast with his wife, Maria. Now, they are caught and bruised and shaken, but they are both safe and well and alive, thankfully. And Anthony joins me on the line now to share his experience. In advance of talking to Anthony, I must warn you, we are talking to Beirut and there is a considerable delay on the line. So, Anthony, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions all in one. Firstly, tell us how long you've been living in Beirut and how you got there. And also tell us what happened yesterday. Were you in your apartment and where? How much of the explosion did you actually see?
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I think mainly I'm now trying to spread awareness and get people over here to help, and inner nation Irish people, we really appreciate it. But, you know, I with my wife now for the year and a half. We got engaged back in February with a plan to get married in Cyprus in May, but then after our engagement in February, she went back to Lebanon, and COVID kind of kept us apart for the next 5 months. The wedding in May was cancelled. We then, the airports flew open. I flew over end of June, start of July, and we got a small apartment here about, you know, 0.5 kilometres by the crow flies from where the blast happened, facing the port, so we got a clear view of the whole thing. And, yesterday it's still ingrained in memory. Our apartment basically has three rooms, a kitchen that faces out onto the port, and then left of that our bedroom, and left of that our guest bedroom slash my office, as I work remotely there. And each room has a floor to ceiling window that kind of just see this amazing view of the harbour. And I had a call at 6 p.m. local time, so I sat down on my monitor while my wife and a woman over have been cleaning the apartment. There's a lot of new appliances there needed cleaning up before we could really call it a home. And whilst in my desk, I saw a building in front of me, again, just half a kilometre away the harbour, gulping smoke. There's nothing obstructing my view. It's just a small two-story building site in front of me, and we're on the sixth floor, so a clear view of this going up. First reaction, I didn't know if it was just a local fire, or, you know, my kind of, you know, being Western Lebanon, the fear is that it was something more sinister. But I didn't hear Maria say anything or shouting or screaming, so I kind of assumed it was just some local accident. I took a photo of my phone to share the guys on my office and Zoom where I just saw off my window, and by the time I pressed click and looked down, the second explosion happened. Looking back and seeing the videos, that was clearly the blast, the mushroom that everyone's seen now that decimated the entire city. But for me, when I was sitting in my room, I thought it was the building next to us exploding. We're next to a hospital and a police station. So immediately, I have to say, like any movie you've seen, it gives it justice. It's kind of a vacuum noise of air. The glass shattered. I was thrown back, thankfully, being in a guest room slash office, onto the bed behind me, not against the wall. Glass everywhere, smoke everywhere, and that ringing in your ear. So when I opened my eyes, struck it into a ball, I saw smoke. That just always heard that was that one long kind of tetanus ringing noise. And then when smoke cleared, the ringing noise went down. I heard the screaming and the shouting and the rubble. And I looked down and saw my covered in blood because I got, you know, lacerations across my head and my legs and feet because I was wearing shorts. But thankfully, my monitor and desk probably took a lot of the damage as well from the glass coming in. My first reaction was to run to Maria, so I called her name, and I heard her shouting in the corridor behind. I hopped over all the glass and barefoot and called her and saw her, then asked, she okay? Asked my other friend who's over cleaning the apartment, had seen the explosion and ducked in behind the corridor where there are no windows. Maria kind of stood there like a deer in the headlights staring at the explosion, and Asma grabbed her and pulled her in. A second later, the blast came right to the kitchen, splitting the kitchen table in half, collapsing the fridge invertedly, and the entire front door of the apartment, including the walls around the front door, blasted off. So we then just, you know, I think she was more shook than I was, because I came in and saw she was completely unharmed, thankfully, but she had so many covered in blood. We opened the safe, got her passports and cash, then her backpacks, ran downstairs barefoot, and then over the next 20-30 minutes walked through the streets. And it was literally something you see in a horror movie. Just every window collapsed, cars inverted, the hostel next to us, like, people who aren't bent out, it's just dead on the spot, and people coming out, we were, their gowns and their drips coming out, and just complete another chaos, everyone trying to get out of the city, or those who were out of the city running back in to try and find their loved ones. Mm. We spent 2.5 hours walking through broken glass and hitchhiking, so we eventually got a taxi to drop us to our father's house up in the mountains. And then after a couple of hostel visits, we found one 50 kilometers south that wasn't too inundated, that they were able to remove the glass and give me stitches. But, you know, we're very grateful and fortunate. We have people outside the city. There are people in Beirut, you know, it's a 4 million population country, 1.5 million living in Beirut. We were very fortunate to have friends and family who were safe outside of the city, and who, you know, other than being the bang and the ground shaking, were no major effects. But, you know, there's at least 300,000 so far homeless at the moment in the city, and this is after going through an economic and political and a COVID crisis all in the same 12-month period. I think out of all the cities in Lebanon, Beirut is the one that was surviving the best, and now they've had a bomb go through it, so the whole country is just decimation, and that's why we're just having these calls to help promote people in Ireland to
of course,
where they can to the Red Cross in Lebanon.
Of course. Initially, I mean, we've seen, I don't know whether you've actually been able to see it on television or not, but it was horrendous. It looked more like something from a Hollywood movie, you know, and the first word that came to my mind was, that's like Armageddon. It was almost like a nuclear mushroom cloud. And then I saw, well, 25, 30, 40, maybe 50 people dead, 2,500 injured. But I thought, my God, that's miraculous if that few people have died, bad and all as that was. What are the latest figures you're seeing there or hearing?
I think you might have better figures than I have, because I remember 6 hours or so after the accident, we were still driving towards the hospital down south, and when I got to north, my father was WhatsApping me, and there was a much clearer image happening internationally at that point, because there's just so much chaos and emergency happening in Lebanon. We were getting drips of information, people just pointing fingers, not sure of what to happen. I think everyone looking for someone to blame, because it's such a massive explosion to be an accident, that people felt there had to be some rhyme or reason to it. But, like, I think the moment we got about 100 or so confirmed dead, but that's the main word is confirmed. Like, you're talking about a port, an explosion that was felt and heard Cyprus across the ocean, that, you know, bodies around the port were flowing to sea, rubble everywhere, people were thrown everywhere. So right now they're only getting confirmed deaths. There's thousands missing, there's 300,000 at least homeless. It's just a national disaster. An analogy I gave in another interview, just to give you a kind of scope, because Ireland and Lebanon, population and size and density, very similar. If you imagine where we were, essentially the sixth floor of a Google or Facebook building in Grand Canal, and the port harbour there is exploding, and imagine every glass window from Blackrock to Howth shattering, and people from down as far as Wicklow Town to Drogheda hearing the noise and wails, the explosion, and for the next 2.5 hours walking through the along the Liffey until you get to the Stanyford Mountains, the mountains, and say Stanyford, the Blue Light Pub, and looking back behind you, just seeing smoke and rubble. That's essentially the equivalent of what would happen if that bomb had gone off in the Docklands in Ireland, to give the context and just the sheer scale of it.
When you describe it like that, Anthony, it's remarkable that the death toll has been as low as it is. It is also remarkable that you are as coherent and as lucid as you are. I doubt very many of us would be able to put it together and retell the story and relate the story as well as you have. Look, first and foremost, you are safe and well. Maria is safe and well, battered, bruised and scratched. I'm sure your families will be delighted about that. For people here, what can they do to help? Who should they go to? What are the best organisations? If they want to make a donation or a contribution, who should they give to?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of options, not international from where, but for my friends who are Lebanese, what they've been sharing are two main groups. One is Red Cross Lebanon. They've been doing work here for years, given the Syrian crisis and things that happen in Palestine. So they're well rehearsed to a lot of emergency taken care of, not this scale, so any donation will be massively appreciated. Or for the longer term effects, so this is going to be a long term rebuilding plan here. There is a group called, it's the website help-lebanon.me, and they basically are the first $500,000 going to go to the Red Cross, and the rest will be spread evenly amongst local charities across the whole country. Because again, this country if you think your 2020 is bad and your pubs have been closed, they've had economic inflation where people, half the country are below the poverty line, they've had political instability, they've had COVID cases spike in the last month, they went in lockdown immediately and had very little interaction with the outside world until the last month or so, and now a bomb has blown up the biggest city and just displaced, you know, a tenth of the population at least right now. It's just going to be a long time kind of counting what
the cost
left
will be. Finally, just before I let you go, have yourself and Maria lost everything? I mean, the flat is completely blown out. I don't know, has the building block that you were in, the apartment block, been damaged so seriously that it'll have to be levelled? But I mean, essentially, you have your passport, you have some money and you have the shirts on your back. Is that about it?
That was about it yesterday when we left the apartment. That's pretty much all we had. And we left and I had to borrow clothes from my father-in-law for the night. But thankfully, some people who were going back to Beirut to try and help people, those who couldn't go back to their homes, try and salvage. And they found a few clothes and things, and they kind of got that into a bag for us. We haven't really gone through yet because it's just covered in glass.
Okay.
But to be honest with you, like, there's a lot of memorable things from our travels last year when we were kind of going around the world before we got engaged that we're just going to lose. But I think in times like these, you have to be stoic and grateful that
you're still alive,
still,
and you
here
can rebuild
we're
your life. Yeah.
Like,
okay. Listen, Anthony Cleary, thank you so much for that. That was a riveting eyewitness account, and it certainly conveys the horror of what you and everybody else there went through yesterday. It is News Talk. It's The Hard Shoulder. We are talking about that explosion in Beirut yesterday. It's still trying to pick up the pieces of that explosion. It has taken, we suspect it'll be hundreds of lives in the end, harmed thousands of people, and put the best part of 300,000 people out on the side of the street with no homes at all. The violent blast was caused by 2,750 tonnes of ammonium nitrate that was being stored unsafely in a warehouse in the city. To discuss this further, Michael Stevens, a Middle East researcher and head of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar, and also our own security and defence analyst, Declan Parr. Thank you both, gentlemen, for waiting and for joining us. Declan, I'll start with you, first of all. Ammonium nitrate, also known as saltpeter, it's been used as an explosive since the Middle Ages, I think, hasn't it? But why would they have nearly 3,000 tonnes of it stored in a warehouse in Beirut?
Well, that is the question, Mark. It's nice to talk to you again. You know, we have some history, local history with that as well. Ammonium nitrate was initially the Provisional IRA's explosive material of choice in the early days of the Troubles. So for listeners, it would give some perspective when they see some of the footage of some of the spectacular bombings in Belfast in the early mid-70s. They would largely have been ammonium nitrate. Now, the thing about it is it's a very effective explosive, but it's very cumbersome. You need a lot of it. And then you need a very effective form of ignition, an effective detonating source. But as you can see, the damage it can do. So that begs the question you've just asked. Why was there so much of it? Well over 2,000 metric tons of it left where it was. Apparently, the only information that's available is that it had been confiscated. Now, that's maybe not entirely disbelievable on the basis that there would have been maybe a number of different elements active in Beirut that the Beirut or the Lebanese government may have moved against at some stages over the last number of years and confiscated this material. But what is very unusual is that material like this can become volatile if it's not monitored and if it's not stored and looked after appropriately. And for that amount, and it appears other explosive elements, because reports are emanating too that while ammonium nitrate may have been the primary explosive source, there may have been all kinds of others, because I'm sure your listeners have seen the footage of it now. Mm. You see one initial explosion and then you see a number of chain reactions moving quite effectively to lead to the large shockwave, which is not unusual. Just to give perspective on this, the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings, which led to 169 fatalities, was caused by 2 tons of ammonium nitrate. So 2 versus what is well over 2,000. And I think, okay, you know, the fatality list has yet to be finalized.
Declan, thank you for that. That's Declan Parr, Security and Defence Analyst. It is News Talk. We're talking about the Beirut bombing yesterday. I'm joined now by Michael Stevens, who's a Middle East researcher and head of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar. Michael, very quickly, it looked awful, and I think everybody's response was, it has something to do with terrorism, and was it all going to kick off in Lebanon and Beirut again? Is this just an appalling, awful accident, or is there possibly something more sinister at play?
Well, I think what seems to me to be the case is that this is, a product of a litany of poor management, government not doing its security checks properly. As it turns out, the port authorities in Lebanon had warned the Lebanese Ministry of Justice 7 times that this product was being stored in the port, and had asked for a decision to do something about it. No decision was made. Now the government are saying that apparently the initial spark was caused by somebody welding in the warehouse. I mean, this is, I've seen pictures of how this ammonia nitrate has been stored, and it is clearly not been done in a safe way. It's been done near a population center, and then somebody apparently is welding right next to it. So I'm still 24 hours later, as somebody that goes to Beirut a lot and has a lot of friends there, in a sort of slight sense of disbelief that so many protocols could have been ignored, so many steps could have been just sort of, you know, brazenly sort of put to the wayside. And then, of course, the problem with Beirut now is that there's only 4 hours of electricity a day. The cooling systems aren't working across the city. It gets up to 40 degrees in the daytime. And I think this was a perfect recipe for disaster.
Given what the country has been through, I mean, it has been war-torn or divided almost all my adult life. And, you know, they've rebuilt the city. I can't count the amount of times they've done that. What does something like this do to Beirut as a city and its economy and as the main driver of the Lebanese economy?
Oh, it's devastating. You know, as was said by both your previous speakers, you know, Lebanon's been going through a really, really difficult time with its economy recently. But, the last time I was there, which was probably 6 to 8 months ago, you know, it was fascinating to see how the port area was developing, how there'd clearly been a lot of money put into the waterfront and the Corniche area. And it was looking so much better than it was even 10 years ago. The reconstruction efforts that had been put in place after the war with Israel in 2006 were really sort of beginning to bear fruit. And well, now it's almost like we're back to square one yet again with Lebanon. It's this sort of endless cycle of destruction and rebuilding. But if there's one country, I think, that can get back on its feet after bad news, it's definitely Lebanon. The problem is this, is that in previous times, there was investment coming from the Gulf Arabs, from France, you know, all these other places that wanted to put money in. The diaspora, the Lebanese diaspora, which is actually larger than the Lebanese population in Lebanon. But now there's no money. And I don't know where that money is going to come from. Unless the government undertakes some serious structural reforms, I doubt the investment will come. And they have defaulted on their debts just 3-4 months ago. So I think this one is going to be very difficult. And I'll be honest, I think that also with the addition of the coronavirus, it's not going to bring the tourism in that they need to help get themselves back on the right path. So my hope is, of course, that, you know, things will change in maybe 2021. But for now, this is going to have a devastating impact. There are other ports in the country, in the north and in the south, but they don't have the logistical supply chains to be able to support the country properly. So I think this is going to put an enormous strain on a country which is already really, really under some turmoil.
Okay, Michael Stevens, thank you so much. That's Michael Stevens, Middle East researcher and head of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar. Thank you, and Declan Parr and Anthony Cleary, for joining us here on News Talk.